Are condos no longer king in South Florida? Why are so many people in the Keys not finding enough to eat? And what does a ban on X in Brazil mean to us here in America? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll take a look at our deepening condominium crisis. As stricter new regulations come online, values are dropping, and so are sales. Could it mean a rental revival here? We'll also examine an acute food insecurity crisis in the Florida Keys, where cost of living struggles keep mounting for Monroe County workers. And we'll discuss why Elon Musk and his social media platform X have been blocked in Brazil, and how it mirrors our own disinformation wars. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. As long as I've been a journalist in South Florida, and that's a quarter of a century, I can't remember a time, except the Great Recession, when my colleagues and I weren't reporting anything but up numbers on condominiums. Construction, sales, values, all those South American buyers paying cash, you name it. In Florida, but especially South Florida, the condo is king, as much a part of our culture as leaving your left turn signal on. But right now, the condo vibe suddenly feels down, down. This summer, condo sales fell as much as 7% in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. The number of condos for sale, meanwhile, jumped 60% in Miami-Dade. That's a recipe for falling condo values, and in Broward, we are seeing median prices drop. What's behind our alarming condo cool-off? Some point to new state regulations coming online in response to the Surfside condo building collapse of 2021. Either way, could this lead to an increase in badly needed rental properties here? Are you someone who's feeling the bloom fall off South Florida's condominium rose? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me here in the studio to help make sense of this is WLRN Senior Economics Editor Tom Hudson. How are you, Tom?
I'm terrific, Tim. Thanks for inviting me.
And also with us is Sandra Einhorn. She's Executive Director of the Coordinating Council of Broward. Sandra, I want to start with you here because you're in Broward, and one of the most recent examples of the new condo gloom we're seeing here is in Pembroke Pines, specifically a complex called Heron Pond Condominiums. 13 of the property's 19 buildings have been declared structurally unsound. This is hardly the first case. It won't be the last. But it seems to capture the South Florida condo zeitgeist, that sense that decades of complacency, if not negligence, has come home to roost. Is that a fair take, Sandra?
Absolutely. In fact, my opening comment was going to be, you know, you nailed it on the head. What do you do when economic impact and safety come to a head? And we're seeing that now with the impact and the implementation of the condo laws that have been passed by the legislature the last couple sessions as a response to the Surfside crisis.
Right. We should point out that because the Heron Pond buildings are only two stories, the complex is not subject to the new state condominium law you just mentioned that issues several new and a lot of people say long overdue safety regulations. But still, does it illustrate that lax attitude toward condo complex maintenance, for example, that we're suddenly having to confront and which may be driving a lot of people out of the condo market now? I mean, a survey of those Heron Pond residents showed 86% now want to sell their units, no?
Of course, naturally. I mean, these new condo laws and specifically with that development in Pembroke Pines, I think it shows just how widespread this issue is. I mean, to think about the fact that this, because it's not three stories or higher, doesn't even have to have some of the new strings attached to the condo law shows that this isn't just for high rises. We're talking about, you know, most of our housing product was built in the 50s and 60s and 70s. These are aged products. And most of the people, especially across Broward and in central Broward, where you've got these condo havens that, as you alluded to, is culturally so much of South Florida.
Yeah.
I think that we're going to find the most vulnerable are going to be the ones that are most impacted, meaning folks, as they were getting older and they wanted to downsize, decided to move into condos, and perhaps they've paid off their condo. So maybe their overall housing costs have gone down, but their income has also gone down as they've gone into retirement, and they're, you know, and they're relying on some of their, you know, Social Security and things like that.
Yeah.
So when you only have to pay insurance or your nominal assessment fee that maybe slowly has been creeping up every year, or every few years, that's vastly different than when you get a six-figure assessment or you're told that now your monthly, you know, your monthly fees are going to double, triple, quadruple.
Yeah.
You now, it now becomes a situation where those that were prudent in thinking, okay, I know that in the future I'm not going to have as much disposable income, let me decrease my cost of living,
yeah,
are now put in a position where they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. What are they going to do, and where are they going to go?
Tom Hudson, what do you feel the Heron Pond debacle tells us about what you aptly call the reckoning that the Florida and especially South Florida condo culture is now facing?
Yeah, vulnerable, affordable, and fixed income communities here are really impacted. And I think this particular condo association, as Sandra aptly put, really highlights the fact that these reform efforts, which this condo association is not subject to because it's only two stories
yeah,
and the legislation is three stories or higher, shows the incredibly poor state of maintenance and fiscal maintenance that so many condominium associations are now dealing with. Because, Tim, this is a decades in the making reckoning for the condominium community throughout Florida, and particularly here in South Florida.
Right. So, Tom, walk us then through how bad the situation looks right now for the condo market here, especially the emerging sales data that,
yeah,
I know you've been doing a lot of reporting on.
The condominium market is shaky right now. The older the, and maybe that's being too polite, Sandra.
At best, yeah, at best.
And here's the hard and fast reality. The older the condo, the more vulnerable it is to this reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
The less financial or fiduciary responsibility that associations have had throughout the course of the past decades, the more vulnerable it is to falling values. 2 months ago, a Republican Florida House member told me she was telling people not to buy a condominium in Florida.
Yeah,
now, imagine any Florida politician, regardless,
right,
of property, telling somebody, hold off on buying a condominium in Florida. That is a remarkable statement and a remarkable admission about how shaky
it's almost uncertain the
market
is. It's like
telling
a meat lover to go vegan.
It's very, very similar. It's like telling a Floridian to bring their snow shovel. These things just don't happen.
Right. Now, Sandra, I mentioned at the outset that in your county, Broward, we have seen condo values drop this summer. Is there a concern there that the market could be headed toward, say, a recession of sorts as a result of these factors we've been talking about, especially condo owners balking at things like new and higher maintenance assessment costs and fees, and a sense that their complexes may not be that structurally sound anymore, as you referred to earlier?
Right. So it's interesting. I think that we're now seeing, you know, the complete opposite of where we were during the economic collapse of 09, 2010, when we converted a lot of apartment units into condos. And so what was ironic is just before COVID, you know, as the affordability crisis really started to come to a head on the single family home side, you saw a lot of folks buying condos because, again, it was a more affordable option. You know, even if you had assessments that were a couple hundred dollars, before COVID, the average price of a condo sale across Broward County was under $200,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it was still affordable. And even if you were part of a prudent HOA that was, you know, aggressive in maintenance, which were few and far in between, let's be honest with that, it was still an affordable option. And so now, you know, certainly single family home ownership is unattainable for more than 95% of Broward County households. And now that we're seeing this issue with condos, it's really going to be interesting to see what happens. We know that the demand is down, you know, demand's been down anywhere from 5 to 9%, depending on what data points you're looking at over the
Yeah.
last couple months. But I think that we're just starting to scratch the surface. You know, parts of the
Right.
law just went in July 1. I think that the new year is going to be a
Yeah.
huge litmus test.
And a
I think the
big
bigger concern is not the immediate impact. And certainly I'm concerned about the immediate impact for the homeowners that aren't going to be able to weather the storm, but really looking out, like what's our long-term plan
Yeah,
to
right.
take dozens, if not hundreds, of condominium buildings across Broward
Right. And
County that are in need of place?
Sandra, let me ask Tom then about that big deadline that's looming, December 31st, when a lot of these new regulations for structural soundness and financial reserves is coming up. What do you think is the biggest issue that's really spooking condo owners and associations when they're looking at that deadline and on into 2025?
It's the uncertainty, but also the certainty that there's an assessment coming, and the uncertainty of how much is it, and that is affecting owners, regardless if they have a mortgage or not. How much is that assessment going to be? How much is it going to draw away from the equity that they may have built up into condominium? And for potential condominium buyers, how much is that special assessment that they could be facing in 2025, 26, and beyond? How much is that going to require a haircut on the offer that they're going to make to try to purchase a condominium? This is a bit of a slow motion reckoning that is now picking up steam as we move to the end of December. And as Sandra mentions, the long tail effects of this in this condominium market in 25, 2026 obviously are going to remain to be seen, but it is going to likely be in this market for some time.
This is the
It's
South Florida. Excuse, excuse, excuse me,
unprecedented.
excuse me, excuse me, Sandra. I just got to do the FCC thing here. Sorry. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Tom Hudson and Sandra Einhorn of the Coordinating Council of Broward about the decline of the condo dream here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Please, apologies, Sandra. Continue your thought there.
No, I was going to say, I mean, it's unprecedented volatility. So, you know, I think that we could make assumptions, but even above and beyond the assumptions, it's not a question of if, it's a question of how many. How many people are going to have to walk away from their condos simply because they're not going to be able to afford the assessment, but the retail value has become so, the retail value has dropped so
Right.
significantly that there
Right.
might not be an option to sell
Yeah.
those units. And
Yeah.
so, for the people that have to walk away, what becomes of them? And for those unoccupied units, what then becomes of that building as a whole that no longer
What
has everyone paying into that assessment?
does that all mean,
You know,
Tom?
for Tim, the valuation for a condominium in Florida had been historically based upon three things: location, location,
Location.
and location,
Location,
right?
right.
But I think because of these reforms being put in place, the three new characteristics that's going to go into values for condominiums is it's a lot like wine. It's location, vintage, and balance.
Right.
And vintage, I mean the age of the condominium, the newer the condo, likely the higher, or the ability to retain value is going to be higher. And by balance, I mean financial balance. What's in the reserves? What's in the bank account for these associations to be able to repair roofs, to be able to do structural repairs in a timely manner? That's what's really going to decide the value of condominiums post reforms here after
So you
Surfside.
have to decide whether your condo is a Cabernet or a Pinot, essentially. Sandra, I want to pivot here to what the condo culture has to do now to save itself from collapse in this state and especially in this region. Can that culture change? And if it does change, will there still be enough appetite for the condo lifestyle here to make it viable, you know, into the coming decades?
Listen, I think the same thing that made condo culture culturally relevant in South Florida is really, I think, what's going to prohibit our ability to really know what's going to happen in the years to come. Meaning you might have some condo buildings that are full of year-round residents, but what about the condo buildings? And I'm not talking about the fancy ones, you know, on the beach that maybe have, you know, affluent second homes from, you know, from people from South America. But what about the snowbirds from Canada that have been coming down, you know, since the 80s that again, might just want to walk away. And so what do you do if you've got a building where 60% of the owners have walked away and 40% of the year-round owners are left holding the bag?
Right. Tom, let me ask Tom the same question from this perspective, though. You had mentioned earlier that one of the legislature's concerns was making sure insurance companies will still want to underwrite condo complexes here. What would you say the insurance industry wants to see change about the condo culture so that it has a future here?
They want to make sure that the fiduciary responsibilities of condominium boards is strong and is upheld and is accountable. And for so long, boards have been able to kick the proverbial can down the road here in Florida. Yeah. And it allowed a lot of folks to live the condo lifestyle with low assessments, low monthly fees, because the underlying value of the condominium continued to shoot up. But in the meantime, the roof wasn't getting repaired properly, or the structural issues in the basement or parking lot weren't being addressed. Right. But yet they were getting new curtains and new carpeting in the lobby.
Yep. We have Richard on the line here from here in Miami, and he's bringing up a subject that I also want to discuss with you and Tom, Sandra. But Richard, this has to do with the rental aspect of this whole situation. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective there?
Thanks. I don't see where rents would go down. To the contrary, the problems are financial for the condo owners. And if they have to bail, I don't see the banks wanting to go into the rental business. The costs still stay the same costs, meaning your insurance, your property taxes, your HOA. So who's going to want to, anyone who is choosing to rent out their place isn't going to be able to discount the rent. They're going to have to try and get the maximum they can, and they're still probably going to be in the negative in terms of what it's costing them to keep the condo versus renting it out. I think you'll also have empty condos because you're going to have people that are going to walk, and there's that interim period.
Right, and we're going to get to that interesting perspective, Richard. Yeah. Thank you, Tom.
And I think Richard's spot on, because in addition, another pricing pressure on apartments in terms of lease rates is the number of new apartments coming to market here in South Florida. And there are thousands of them, 14,000 in South Florida here in 2024, new apartments coming to the market, 76,000 by 2028. And this is on top of the 73,000 new apartments that were added to this market just within the past 4 years. Now, population demand has helped fill those up, but that's also supply into the rental market.
Yeah, Sandra, let me bring that subject to you as well. I mean, are we, you know, sort of ironically looking at a silver lining here? When we talk about the larger context of the South Florida housing crisis, if this condo collapse, for lack of a better word, keeps going, could that bring badly needed rental units, coming more of them online in South Florida, and making renting more affordable here?
As the eternal optimist, I don't know that I'm prepared to say that there's a silver lining that to this situation. Yeah. Dominantly because above and beyond the condo laws, we're still dealing with an insurance crisis. And so whether it's apartment or it's condo, you've still got the insurance crisis. You know, we're in the middle of hurricane season, so it would be foolish to not bring up the fact that, you know, while I think that there needs to be some, you know, some statewide jurisdiction over some of these things, different counties have different impacts on storms, depending on, you know, a whole host of things. And so I think that it's going to get a whole lot worse before we're going to be able to look at a possible silver lining.
Okay.
I do think that there are different stakeholders that are committed to looking at what those silver linings might be.
Yeah. Tom, finally, then, looking ahead at the new state legislative session next year, people like Miami-Dade Mayor Levine Cava are urging legislators to prioritize this issue and maybe tweak or reform the reforms that they passed last year.
Yeah, there
may be. Do you think that'll happen?
I do think it's going to get a lot of attention, and there'll probably be some legislation in here, maybe not easing the reforms, but perhaps kind of acknowledging the fact that there's a lot of reforms put in place after a number of years of ignoring the reforms that were necessary.
The legislature will have seen 3 months of experience with the reforms in place. I think there will be places that they're going to look to tweak.
Yeah.
But also the insurance industry is going to be watching to make sure that the overall accountability remains very strong.
All right. A lot to come still. Indeed. Tom Hudson is WLRN Senior Economics Editor. Sandra Einhorn is Executive Director of the Coordinating Council of Broward. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've talked on this program about how hard it is to make ends meet if you're a worker in the Florida Keys. It's a problem in any local economy that depends on the low-wage tourism sector. We know housing is increasingly scarce and unaffordable for Monroe County's workers, but now we're discovering that getting enough food is becoming a problem for more and more people in the Keys. Food pantries there are struggling to stay supplied because they've seen demand almost double in recent years. Tom Callahan, the CEO for the SOS Foundation, the largest food pantry operator in the Keys, said this to WLRN Keys reporter Julia Cooper recently.
The bottom line is Monroe is really starving right now. If you talk to any of the food pantries from Key Largo to Key West, they're going to tell you the same thing. We simply don't have enough food to meet the demand.
In fact, about 1 in 8 Monroe County residents faced food insecurity in 2022, according to the latest data from the Chicago nonprofit Feeding America. So how did the situation get this dire in the Keys? And what can both government and nonprofits do to make the community there more food secure? I spoke about this with WLRN's Julia Cooper, whose report aired last week.
Julia, how did you become aware that getting enough food has become such an acute problem in the Keys? I just cited the Feeding America food insecurity data, but how is this showing up on the ground there in Monroe County?
So I have been aware of the affordability issues that are in the Keys because of past reporting that I've done. And I had this inkling that it might be, kind of seeping into other areas of life, like food availability. And so what I started doing was just having chats with people. I went down to a local pantry down in Key West, chatted with their pantry manager, and the reporting took me there, took me from there. And so what I saw was that as demand is doubling for foods, less and less food is becoming available from the corporate and private partners that pantries usually turn to.
Right. Now, you mentioned in your report that food pantry supplies, for example, have diminished since the COVID-19 pandemic. So is this the case of a supply chain crisis hitting a remote and harder to reach region like the Keys?
Certainly that is one of the big issues. Yes, because of our unique geography, it is much harder to have goods shipped into our area. But it's a number of different things, from issues in the agriculture sector to government contract issues that are all kind of culminating into this issue of less food being available for our local residents.
Yeah, now, this past summer was particularly worrisome there. Remind us why summer is such a difficult time for food insecure families.
Summer is always an issue for pantries that want to stay stocked up properly for the people that they serve. And that is because typically the families that rely on the pantries rely on them even more during the summer months when their kids are not in school and getting
right.
those free and reduced lunches that school districts do provide for kids.
Remind us how difficult the cost of living situation has become in the Keys in general for a typical working class family. You cite a United Way study in your report, for example, that seemed pretty telling.
Yeah, so the threshold for what it takes to have a typical family of four stay above living paycheck to paycheck is rising. And so what it is most recently is that a family of four, it takes about $98,000 a year to just, again, stay above means for them. That's nearly $100,000. It's nearly six figures just to be living comfortably in the area.
And you also, I think, pointed out, given that situation, just how much of a percentage of their incomes are these families spending on housing, for example, that makes it even difficult then to dole out the cash that's needed for food.
Yeah, absolutely. Both the cost of food and transportation are rising for these households, and so they're having to spend more and more on those things.
Transportation, tell us how that's becoming an acute financial problem for families as well in the Keys.
Things like having to pay for gas, which I mean every person has to do, is also becoming more difficult, I would say.
Right. And we've talked before about how the Keys is struggling with trying to provide more public transit, buses and things of that nature for Keys workers to get to jobs and get around in general, right?
Absolutely, but all the infrastructure that they're imagining for these transit systems aren't there yet. We're in the very early stages of planning out a fully fleshed public transit system in the Keys.
Right. So let's get back to the food issue then. Tell us, Julia, how much this food insecurity stress has grown for food pantries in the Keys and how they're coping with it. You point, for example, to community food drives as one stopgap measure they've been trying recently.
Absolutely. So, some of the things that they're dealing with is less food availability, but less quality food available to them. And so, what they're having to do is diversify the sources that they're getting this food from to ensure that they just have enough to work with. And so, like you mentioned, one of those things is turning back to the community. Donation drives is certainly a big thing, but also turning to private partners like local restaurants and hotels and partnering with them to see if they will be generous enough to donate either monetarily or direct goods.
And as I said, though, that those are stopgap measures in many ways. In the meantime, what were some of your conversations with these struggling families in the Keys like?
Yeah, it's tough to hear people say they rely on these services week after week, and they're seeing less and less of what they need, right? These are people with large families. These are individuals that no longer can work due to injury or disability. And it's yeah, it was tough.
What were some of the ways that they expressed to you that they're trying to stretch out their own household food supplies? That, how are they making this work in a situation like this?
Yeah. And it is just a matter of stretching that food out where they can, sorting through all of the goods that they get, really taking a look at, is this something that I'm comfortable with eating? Food pantries often accept expired food,
Yes.
and that is, slightly past due, but it's probably still good to consume. And they're having to say, like, is this an expiration date that I'm willing to look past this time?
And I want to go back to what you pointed out earlier then. This relates to this other issue that you point out, that even when families in the Keys can find affordable food or food at pantries these days, the quality of it perhaps is becoming increasingly questionable.
Absolutely, yeah. So something they're seeing is, again, as there's less food available, the quality is also diminishing. They're seeing the produce that's coming in already have mold on it. And so these are things that, yeah, people are concerned, like, can I eat this? Is this safe for me?
I'm Tim Padgett. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm speaking with WLRN's Julia Cooper about the troubling food insecurity problem for a growing number of families in the Florida Keys. So, Julia, let's talk about some of the possible fixes to this problem down there. Your report references, for example, a U.S. Department of Agricultural program called the Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP. What's the issue there?
So TFAP is a federal program that a lot of different food pantries across the country use. In the Florida Keys, the food that comes in from this program is distributed by Feeding South Florida, an arm of Feeding America. And what's happening with these contracts is that they are seeing them fall through sometimes. Really, since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, they see that the suppliers of food, these farmers, have gotten a lot more savvy with what they can grow and where they can sell them. And so they're seeing that some people that they used to turn to fulfill these contracts are no longer accepting them because they're able to sell their goods at a higher rate somewhere else.
Well, what Can then, for example, an agency like the U.S. Department of Agriculture do to start re-incentivizing contractors like these to steer this food and their products again to these people who need it in places like the Keys?
Yeah, I wouldn't know what the incentivization might be, but I think one thing that I spoke with the CEO for Feeding South Florida, and one thing that he said was he and his team are really trying to diversify where they turn to for contracts. So, you know, farms, big and small, geographically diverse, so that they don't run into issues where, you know, one kind of farm or one area of farms is being affected, and then they don't have anywhere to turn to fulfill those orders.
Right. So it sounds like they're having to rethink the entire contracting scheme.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's going to be difficult. What more can the state do in this context? We should mention that Florida state government recently rejected another federal food assistance program called Sunbucks. Why did it do that, and what effect has this had?
So yes, that would have been that would have been federal dollars coming in to help Florida families. And the Department of Children and Families did reject getting that funding for that program. And what their official statements have been so far is that they're confident in, you know, the infrastructure that we have currently to be able to successfully serve children. And they didn't want to accept the, quote, federal strings that might be attached with accepting more federal funding.
What sort of federal strings are they referring to?
That has been vague that has been vague. What we do know is that is the official statement from them, and we haven't gotten anything more.
Right. I'm sorry, I interrupted you there. You were going to make another point about this.
Yeah. So Sunbucks no longer being, Sunbucks not being available to households in Florida means that it's affecting 2 million low-income children.
Wow. But as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, the food supply chain factor is big here. How are both government and nonprofits and the private sector, for that matter, working to fix that fundamental problem? We talked earlier about trying to reconstruct the contracting arrangement, but what can be done to loosen up or unclog that food supply chain problem that's been with us since the COVID-19 pandemic, but is particularly acute, as we've mentioned, in remote areas like the Keys? What can they do?
Yeah. I spoke with the CEO for Feeding South Florida. I also spoke with the CEO for FarmShare. That is another food bank that local Keys pantries rely on. And again, he said the same thing. It's a matter of looking to diversify their sources. And that has been their solution thus far.
Right. And you mentioned FarmShare, pretty well known here, especially in South Dade, as well as the Keys. So I wanted to ask you finally, one of the important things you mentioned in your report is the disappearance of farming in the Keys, which also makes it very difficult to keep that supply of food to places like food pantries going. How has that disappearance of farming in the Keys made a huge difference these days?
Yeah. So again, Stephen Shelley, who's the CEO of FarmShare, what he said he's seeing is local farmers, particularly in South Florida, being pushed out by development off of their lands. And these agricultural lands that used to produce fresh produce for them, again, turn into these residential properties, other kinds of development. And so there is less farming happening in the area because of that.
Right. And do the food pantries say that has really had, an acute impact on their ability to keep supplies on their shelves?
Absolutely. Certainly FarmShare is one of their bigger partners that they rely on for that fresh produce. And so them not having as much available to them has really had an effect as well.
And it hasn't helped that what agriculture is left in the Keys is having to deal with blights like citrus greening. And I know you mentioned that this is a problem statewide in Florida, but when an agricultural blight like that comes to a remote area like the Keys, it really exacerbates things, no?
Yeah, absolutely. So citrus greening is a bacterial infection that can make citrus trees sick. And that is, again, something happening across the state. what Shelley said was that the citrus industry previously didn't have a lot to donate off of what they were producing anyway. But again, things like greening don't help that. It exacerbates that, that they really hold on to the products that they are able to produce and just sell them through normal channels instead of having enough to donate elsewhere.
Right. And when we're talking about feeding families and kids, citrus fruit is a pretty important ingredient.
Yeah, some of the things that I saw at the pantries when I visited were oranges being handed out. And again, when they are tight like that, it comes down to the pantry managers to say, okay, how do we stretch this out instead of maybe, you know, two or three oranges per family this week, we can only give out one. So yeah, it is very important produce.
Yeah. No, as I said at the outset, this is quite a conundrum for them. Julia, many thanks for making us aware of this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on.
That was WLRN's Keys reporter, Julia Cooper. You can read and hear Julia's report on the food insecurity crisis in the Keys at WLRN.org and see a list of food pantries there that you can help. Since billionaire Elon Musk bought the social media platform known then as Twitter 2 years ago and changed its name to X, the Cyber Bulletin Board has become an anything-goes arena whose content more and more is just, well, lies, disinformation, and especially right-wing disinformation since Musk is now a Donald Trump supporter. But X is running afoul of some foreign governments, most recently Brazil, where the Supreme Court this week affirmed its ban on X because of all those untruthful posts. Musk claims the Brazilian High Court is violating free speech, and when viewed through our First Amendment lens here, he may be right. But with a U.S. presidential election looming, Musk's Brazil battle raises serious questions that we need to deal with, too, especially here in South Florida, where Spanish-language media disinformation is so rampant. How do we confront disinformation that's harmful to our democracy without harming the free speech rights that are vital to our democracy? Call us with your thoughts on the question at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to help us tackle that conundrum is Anthony Pereira. He's the director of Florida International University's Latin America and Caribbean Center and an expert on Brazil, including judicial issues like this one. Tony, always great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tim.
So as I mentioned, the big immediate issue here is the Brazilian Supreme Court's ban on X in Latin America's largest market. And this involves one Brazilian justice in particular, Alexandre de Moraes, a liberal who is known for cracking down on social media expression there that he considers a threat to the country's democracy. He obviously felt that way about a lot of the disinformation content on X, and a panel of Supreme Court justices agreed with him this week there. But Tony, for one of my reports on Brazil last year, you and I discussed Moraes and how the Brazilian Supreme Court seems to at least seriously flirt with muzzling free speech. Explain for us where Brazil and its own constitutional culture are when it comes to issues like these.
Yeah, we've talked about this, Tim. I think Brazil has a kind of unusual set of laws about elections that prevent candidates from abusing their economic and political power to spread disinformation. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's a different context from the U.S. one. And I think I liked your article about this, by the way. Musk's Brazil ban reminds us U.S. democracy is stronger than Exodus.
My column for WLRN this week.
Yeah, and I think you're spot on by saying that it's pretty clear that Moraes has probably crossed the line from deplatforming for sedition and for real threats, real potential harms, right, and going into the area of opinions. Uh-huh. You know, I think there's a sense that he's been gone too far, even though he had five, you know, he had a quorum of five judges approve this banning of X. But I think Musk is also, I think what's fascinating about this is that both Musk and Alexandre de Moraes are deeply flawed when it comes to the principles they claim to be upholding. One is upholding democracy and the other is upholding freedom of speech. And I think if you unpack what they're doing, they're both flawed characters.
No, good point. And have Brazilians themselves been critical or at least questioning of the Supreme Court's ban on X?
Oh, yeah. This divides Brazilian public opinion right down the middle, I think. It's pretty close in terms of who supports whom.
Uh-huh.
But I think to really contextualize this, you have to go back to January 8th, 2023.
Oh, yeah. And I want to get to that a little later. But I also wanted to ask you, we should mention last year, Brazil's Supreme Court Election Tribunal banned former right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro,
yeah.
who has to do with what you're bringing up there, yeah. from running for office
yeah.
again for quite a few years because he had engaged in disinformation about the 2022 presidential election. He lost, and those judges considered that disinformation that he was spreading harmful to Brazilian democracy. But again, why does Brazil seem so much more ready to legally punish people or companies like X for utterances that may be untruthful but aren't necessarily harmful, you know, sedition,
yeah.
like
yeah.
you mentioned,
yeah.
That aren't threatening the safety of a person or the public?
I think partly because it's a country that has suffered from authoritarian interventions.
Good context.
It had
yeah.
a military coup in 1964.
Right, and a military dictatorship that lasted into the 80s. Yeah,
yeah. And disinformation was part of that coup attempt, mm-hmm. Or that successful coup attempt. And there have been interventions before. You go back to the 1930s. You go back to the 1950s.
Yeah.
You even go back to the beginning of the Republic. The Republic was established by a military coup to overthrow the monarchy.
Right.
So I think there's a sensitivity there about the use of information accompanying violent acts that is maybe doesn't exist in the U.S.
Boy, that's a fantastic point for us to keep in mind. But Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva this week sort of backed up the Supreme Court when he said that just because ex-owner Elon Musk is an American billionaire, quote, the world isn't obligated to tolerate his right-wing free-for-all. Now, on the one hand, Lula is right. On the other hand, Lula is a leftist, and I haven't yet heard him complain about a left-wing free-for-all when media like the socialist Venezuelan dictatorship's mouthpiece known as Telesur is allowed to disgorge its own disinformation inside Brazil. Is there a double standard going on in Brazil in that regard?
I think a lot of people involved in this have double standards. I think you've pointed it out for Lula. For Musk, you know, you'd think, well, he should be outraged about China. You know, China has absolutely prohibited X, or Twitter as it was then, since
yeah.
2000.
Right. And Google and platforms right. like that. Yeah.
Does he criticize that? Does he complain about that? No. He says he has a great relationship with China and
uh-huh.
that it's a win-win relationship because he has a Tesla factory in Shanghai.
Right.
So he's willing to, you know.
And he's had double dealings with India, too.
Exactly.
Modi,
yeah. He deplatformed people in India when Modi wanted government critics to be silenced. He had no problem with that. He
mm-hmm.
deplatformed people in Turkey when Erdogan wanted critics to be silenced before his re-election. So he's very selective in when he decides. And I think if he'd really wanted to defend the free speech rights of people on Twitter in Brazil, he could have maintained a representative and challenged these things legally.
A legal representative, as
yes.
the Supreme Court wanted him to do.
And
yeah.
push the legal boundaries and have
yeah.
a debate, because that's what Brazil needs. Alexandre de Moraes himself wrote a thesis this year to become a full professor of law at the Faculty of Law in the University of Sao Paulo. And he said, we need legislation to deal with this. You know, he kind of admitted,
right.
I as a single judge can't deal with this. We need to discuss this as a society and pass some regulation.
And I want to go back to that historical context that you mentioned earlier. At the same time, how much of this, Tony, stems from the fact that Brazil did see its own January 6th, when many of Bolsonaro's right-wing supporters committed their own insurrection in, as you said, January of 2023, and violently ransacked federal buildings in Brasilia in an attempt to overthrow that 2022 election Bolsonaro lost. Tony, can we draw a line from that mob event to the Brazilian Supreme Court saying, we're not going to tolerate Elon Musk's so-called right-wing disinformation free-for-all inside Brazil?
Absolutely. It's a great point. And that's the context that people have to keep in mind to understand this current battle. It was almost 2 years ago, but people on social media were using a code name called Festa de Selma, or the Selma Party. And they were spreading information about where you could get a bus to go to Brasilia, and they were using words like war, occupy Congress, and overthrow the government.
Right.
And it's clearly not everyone.
And then we're crossing the line into
yes.
the from untruthful to harmful.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what I would compare this to is what Henrique Tarrio, the Proud Boy leader,
from here in
was
Miami,
convicted
yeah.
for 22 years mm-hmm. in a federal jury, for using social media to encourage people to attack the Capitol. It's very, very similar what was going
yeah.
on social media in Brazil prior to January 8th and what happened with Henrique Tarrio. So
yeah.
that is not a free speech issue. That is that is criminal organization to overthrow the government that is not protected, you know, either in the Brazilian Constitution or the U.S. Constitution.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with FIU's Anthony Pereira about Brazil's ban on the social media platform X, Elon Musk's free speech claims, and what it might mean for our democracy's disinformation plague. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And speaking of callers, we have Candace, from Palm Beach. Candace, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective on all this?
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Thank you.
Yes. Excellent. Mr. Pereira is given some information that I agree with him, but I disagree with him with a lot of things. Okay?
Okay.
So one of the things that he's just specifying, it is about that Elon Musk has been out of Brazil because of the free speech. It's not because only of that. One of the things was that, but the main issue was because he did not want to put a representative to run X in Brazil. And because he didn't want nobody to represent him there, that's the reason why.
Okay.
It was given certain errors and plus, finalize this here. Plus, about the free speech, it is because Elon Musk disagree with the Supreme Court of our country, which completely, we have nothing to do with him. He's nothing.
Right.
In relation to our country. Mm-hmm. And because he disagreed, because the Supreme Court didn't want to leave the people lying there. So they imposed him, and Elon Musk just liberate their accounts again, and the people start to put fakes again.
Okay.
For those two reasons.
All right. Well, Candace,
Candace,
I'm sorry. We have to leave it there for time. I apologize, but thank you very much thank you very much. Do you have a response there, Anthony?
I agree with the caller. It's in the civil code. It's part of the law that a company like X has to have a representative in Brazil, and
right.
if you don't have a representative in Brazil, you're subject to the consequences. And so when Musk said that, you know, that Alexandre de Moraes was a pseudo judge who was unelected, I mean, with all due respect to his opinion, Supreme Court justices in the United States are not elected, and you know, Alexandre de Moraes, for all, you know, he's a judge. He's not a pseudo judge.
But I want to look at a larger picture here, Tony. Do you think countries like Brazil, and for that matter, Great Britain, where you were recently working and teaching before you came to FIU, and where there it's also less, there's a lot less legal tolerance for, say, libel and slander and disinformation.
Yeah.
Do you think these other countries feel that we here in America take our First Amendment culture too far? Do they feel we're too free speech extreme in this country?
I think they do. So if you look at where regulation of the internet and social media, and you know, both public and private media, social media platforms, has gone the farthest, it's the European Union. You know, and I think a lot of other countries are going to move in that direction because of these issues,
mm-hmm.
because of how complicated they are. I think we tend to think of free speech as defending the lone wolf journalist, the dissident,
right.
the person who has the guts in a town hall meeting to get up and say, I don't agree with anybody. I have this opinion and it's against all of yours. However, a lot of free speech, it ends up being invoked by very powerful corporations and governments that are using AI, machine learning, bots, fake accounts to dump massive amounts of disinformation into the social media space for their own interests. And I think that's where we have to parse this and try to get it right.
And just really quickly, Tony, finally, I want to bring this question closer to home here. We've got a rampant disinformation problem on Spanish language media, especially radio. How do we get the Latin American diasporas here to take this matter more seriously themselves?
I think one is not to go too far, you know, not to go in the Alexandre de Moraes way and just shut everything down. I think we have to leave space open for people to give, you know, information that's not correct, but that's not harmful.
Right.
And just contest it in the way that we're talking about it now.
Unfortunately, I've got to leave it there for time. Anthony Pereira is the director of Florida International University's Latin America and Caribbean Center. Tony, thanks as always.
Thank you, Tim.
Finally on the Roundup.
Guantanamera, 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 Guantanamera.
Celia Cruz, the queen of salsa, can now be found dancing in your pocket change. If you're one of the many Miamians trying to get your hands on a quarter that features the legendary Cuban-American singer with her catchphrase, azúcar, here's good news. The U.S. Mint has shipped nearly 4 million of the limited edition quarters to Florida. We could start seeing them this month. Celia Cruz is the first Afro-Latina to be presented on U.S. currency and one of the five historic female figures selected for the U.S. Mint's 2024 American Women Quarters program. Cruz, who died in 2003, won 5 Grammy Awards and, of course, a star in the Calle Ocho Walk of Fame here in Miami. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast each week in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show's produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis and Elise Gregg. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.